حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. أما بعد فقد قال الله الحكيم في كتابه المتين بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولقد كان لكم في رسول الله أسوة حسنة صلوات على محمد وعلى محمد. After the prophethood was handed over to the Prophet, the mission began. 10 years have passed, and the Messenger of Allah is making trips to different places in order to give the message of Islam there. When you look at the process of tabligh, you see at first Allah had asked the Prophet to keep the tabligh hidden and not inform everyone openly regarding it. Then after that, the command, it came to the people, here to him, to inform his relatives. He says, "Anzir ashirataka al-aqrabin." He said that, inform those who are near you, your relatives. It started from there. And then after that, Allah asked him to open and openly announce his message to the people. Then after that, a time came when Allah had said to him, وَلَتَنْظُرْ أُمَّ الْقُرَى وَمَنْ حَوْلَهُ. He says, inform the people of Makkah and those that are around them. مَنْ حَوْلَهُ means go around now and inform the people around in the areas that are lying around Makkah. And that's why you see the messenger obeying the words of Allah went around, and one of the places he went to was Taif. Now, if you remember last week, I explained about the harsh treatment that he was met with in Taif. And he was removed from there like you would remove a wild animal. And after, it was so hard for him there, and it was so insulting and offending, the things that he faced there was such that he even remembered that even after the Battle of Uhud was very hard for him. But there are many close companions, dear companions, who were martyred in the Battle of Uhud. And when they asked him, what is the hardest time that you had in your life, he remembered Taif. And he remembered, you know, what a hard time he had over there. Now, as he left the place, as he left this town, he was on his way back to Makkah. Now, the issue that he was faced with is this, that if a person leaves Makkah, then the law of Makkah was that in order to return to Makkah, you need to have the okay of one of the leaders of the tribes that are existing there. Now, anyone would leave Makkah, they would return to their tribe. And the leader of the tribe would obtain the halif for him. Halif was, for example, a visa that he's allowed to stay here, residence, you know, that he can stay here in Makkah. This was the way. Now, it wasn't an issue for the Prophet until the death of his uncle Abu Talib. Because he was the head of the tribe, and any time the Prophet left Makkah, then he would be allowed to return to Makkah. But now that his uncle was no more, and the head of their tribe was Abu Lahab, and Abu Lahab obviously wanted the Prophet to be killed or harmed, he would not allow him to come back to Makkah. So the issue was, how is he going to come back to Makkah? He had left Makkah. Now the issue is, who's going to allow him to come back to Makkah? He just can't come back there. Now, obviously, he would be going against the law, and his life also would be in danger. But when we look at the iman of the Prophet and the trust that he had in Allah, he wasn't afraid of his life. I mean, a lot of times you might think that, hey, you know what, you know, like for example, if he's a mu'min, he would just go into Makkah and then see what happens after that. But you see that the Messenger of Allah is trying to create an example for all of us. What do we do in this type of situation? Do we put our life in danger? Right? So here, he did not go into Makkah. I mean, he could have, like in hiding, just sneaked into Makkah, but he did not choose to do that. He had to obtain a visa into Makkah. Who was going to give him the visa? And by this, he gave an example for us that it's not about that I'm afraid to lose my life. On one hand, there's a law and that you have to abide by the law of the land. And two, the other part is that to sacrifice your life for Allah is very recommended in Islam. In fact, the rank of shahadat is a rank that is the utmost rank in Islam. But when we look at that, the opposite of that is also true. Meaning that to give your life in the way of Allah has a great reward and a great rank in the eyes of Allah. But the opposite of that, to take your life for no reason and to commit suicide, is that much of a sin also. So a lot of people need to recognize the difference between shahadat and recognize the difference between suicide. Right? Shahadat is what Allah asked us to do. And the fact is that what is the way of doing that, that also comes through aql and through reasoning. Right? And through the right opportunity and time and the right cause. When he was headed back, he had to stop in a town outside of Makkah, a small place outside of Makkah called Nakhla. Now he stayed in Nakhla for some time in order to get the permission to enter Makkah. Now, this was the place in Nakhla that you had the incident of a group of jinn who were on their way from Yemen to Sham. And the jinn, it is said that it was in the early, like at late in the night, right, which was the time for Amaz-e-Shab. The jinn who were on their way, they heard the recitation of the Quran. And it was so compelling that they were forced to come down and listen. They just were attached to it. They were just like attracted to it, enchanted by it. They came there and they were listening to the recitation of the Quran, and that too by the Prophet of Allah, who's reciting the Quran. And he recited the Quran, and the ayat he was reciting was from Surah Rahman. He was reciting Surah Rahman. And the jinn who were there were so much enchanted by this that they met the Prophet. And every time he would say, فَبِأَيِّ آلَاءِ رَبِّكُمَا تُكَذِّبَانِ. So they would say, وَلَا بِشَيَّمْ مِن نِعْمَةِ رَبِّكَ نُكَذِّبُ. That we do not deny any of the bounties that Allah has given us. Every time he would say that, they would say this line, وَلَا بِشَيَّمْ مِن نِعْمَةِ رَبِّكَ نُكَذِّبُ. And this was a saying of theirs that we see the Rasulullah, when he went to Medina, encouraged the Muslims. And he said, what is happening to you that you should try to follow the seerat of those jinn who came to me, that when I was saying, فَبِأَيِّ آلَاءِ رَبِّكُمَا تُكَذِّبَانِ, when you hear this, you should say what they said, وَلَا بِشَيْءٍ مِّن نِعْمَةِ رَبِّكَ نُكَذِّبُ. This became mustahab in Islam to say that. And these people, these jinn that were there, they all accepted Islam. There were about 19 of them. They accepted Islam and they went back to inform their people, and they also came back. And this is mentioned in Surah Ahqaf. The whole incident is mentioned in Surah Ahqaf from ayat number 29 to ayat number 33. Where when they heard this, Allah says that they came by, they heard this, and they were so enchanted by it, they came there, and they attested to what? was being read. And then he said that they went back to their people and they informed him. And they warned their people that, listen, we have heard the words that testify what came to Musa. The words that came to Musa, we testify that we need to accept it before we are going to be sent to the hellfire. We need to accept this. And the others also accepted, and they came later. All the other jinn, they came later in what is known at a place outside of Makkah, which nowadays is in Makkah, is a place where the jinn came and they accepted Islam at the hands of the Prophet. And that was the incident that happened later because of this jinn, this group of jinn who heard it, and they went back and informed the people. This happened, this incident happened in this place called Nakhla. And in this place in Nakhla is where the Prophet now wanted to inform the people. I mean, he wanted to get someone to be his Khalif, to be the one to say that he's allowing him to come inside. So at first he sent message to an individual in Makkah that he was related to through his mother. He was a leader of the tribe, of a tribe there, and he informed him that that his name was Ud'ud ibn Sharif. And he informed him of that, and Ud'ud replied back to him, I would love to do it, but I myself am not originally a Makkan. They will not accept my guarantee. If I do it, they will not accept me, because I'm not from them. I have Khalif from someone else who is a Makkan. And that's the reason it's not going to work if I do it. So then Rasulullah, after that, he sent a message to Suhail ibn Amr. Now who is this Suhail ibn Amr? He was the person who came from the side of the Quraysh to sign the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. He's the one who said that, I do not accept him as Rasulullah. He sent a word to him to become his Khalif. And Suhail, when he heard that, right away he said, listen, I want to kill you. How can I ask you to come into Makkah, right, and to give safety for your life? Well, no, there's no way I'm going to do that. He rejected that. And then after that, you see, at the end, he sent a message to Mat'am ibn Uday. He was also a relative of the Prophet from the side of Abdul Muttalib. He was one of those individuals who helped the Prophet come out of the embargo that was held against him. So he, when he heard about that and he got the message from the Prophet, he agreed to do it. He sent back the message that, yes, I will give you Khalif and Half. And he became his Khalif. But in order to enter Makkah, it wasn't easy. So we see that Rasulullah sneaked into Makkah in the middle of the night. In the middle of the night, he was sneaked into Makkah. He went to the house of Mat'am. He stayed there until the early morning hours, meaning it was, like, for example, late in the night. And then he went to the Kaaba. He went to the Kaaba and he started to pray there. Mat'am informed his relatives, right, to come together, right, and we are going to go around the Kaaba and around the Prophet with our bare swords. And when the time will come, they made the plan that they are going to give the halaf, so then no one can say anything. So they said, you know, the idea was that wherever you see the messenger, we be just around him in the area. And if anything happens, we come to his defense. You see, it wasn't easy just to enter Makkah and say, okay, I'm here now. And it was morning time then. After he prayed the Hajar prayer, we see Rasulullah, he went to Hajar Aswad and he held the drape of the Kaaba. He held the drape of the Kaaba. And then as he was there, Abu Jahl saw him. Right away, Abu Jahl, when he looked at him, he started to shout, the enemy we have been looking for is here. Attack him right now before you lose him. Kill him right now. And everyone, they looked around to see where he is, and they saw him. And right away, you see, Mat'am came and made the announcement that, no, he is my Khalif, and I am giving him protection. No one dare touch him. If you touch him, then you have to face my tribe. And everyone came around him with swords, and people saw that. Then they let him go. That's how you see Rasulullah made his way back to Makkah. He made his way back to Makkah. Now, when you look at his life, you know, you see that every moment of his life is a challenge, and every moment of his life was a trial. And he was there, and when he came back that night, the same day, that night, he went to Mat'am, and he thanked him for the Khalif, and he said, now you can take the Khalif back. You can take the Khalif back. He said, but why? If I'm going to take it back, your life is in danger. He said, no. Now it's in my hand. Now it's between me and Allah. But it is against the honor of the Prophet to be in the half of a mushrik even for a day. Now, the issue is, why did he go in the half of a mushrik in the first place? That's the issue that we must understand. Really, if you look at the training of the Prophet that he gave, you know, if Allah had wanted, he could have sent a mu'jiza, right, and a miracle, and you know, and he would have been there in safety. No one could do anything. The exact same way he saved him in the night of Hijrat. He could have done that. But you see that the Prophet knew that these situations are going to come throughout history. And mu'mineen will be faced with these situations where their life would be in danger. If I said the presence of a mu'jaza and I'm saved with a mu'jaza, then the mu'mineen can't expect a mu'jaza to come. Realistically speaking, there must be a way out of this situation for mu'mineen. So Rasulullah made this happen and did this so that mu'mineen can understand there will be times when you will have to take refuge of kuffar in order to save yourself and to propagate Islam. This was the reason that we should have that allowance, that we are not able to have a mu'jaza. We cannot have that trust and iman that he has in Allah. But we will be faced with those situations. What can we do in those situations? There Rasulullah has taught us through this that yes, you're allowed to do that. It doesn't mean you're weak in faith. That's the only way that you are able to save yourself. Then use that way, because there you see your iman will not be shown as weak. You are following the method of the Prophet. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. This, my friends, when you look at this, he came back to Makkah, but after the death of Abu Talib and after the half was taken away, the situation became so bad that even those companions who had gone through all kinds of cruelty, they also started to lose patience. If you remember, for example, Khabbab, whose whole back was seared and was burned. If you remember him, he came to the Prophet and he expressed his loss of patience and said to the Prophet, how long are we going to go through this? How long are we going to... It's getting too much now to bear. Really, it was getting hard for them to bear. And that's why you see Rasulullah was making arrangements with the tribes that are nearby Makkah, because he knew in Makkah they're not safe. He was going and making deals and trying to get the other tribes to accept Islam. And in these days that he was there for 3 years, it is said that he went to more than 100 tribes in order to give the message of Islam to them. More than 100 places he went to give the message of Islam to them. Now, I don't want to go through each and every one of them, but to give you some examples of what he faced when he went there. So you get an idea of what are the people who he faced, and then see the similarities that we face today and the arguments that are being given today. Send me a salawat. One example of this is that a tribe by the name of Banu Fakhr, that they used to live near Iran. And obviously, they were impressed by Iran. Iran was such a big and glorious place and an empire, and it was right next to them. So obviously, they looked at Iran as a superpower. So with this tribe, what happened is that he went there in order to give them the message. The leader of the tribe, he met him, and as he met him, and he said, "What is your message?" So Rasulullah began giving the message. He was impressed by the message. He was like, "Wow, you know, it's all good." But, you know, the idea was this, that the issue that the Prophet was having is that these tribes that are outside of Makkah were so impressed with Makkah. They were so impressed with Makkah that they did not, I mean, they were blinded by them. Because of the fact they said that the Quraysh are the custodian of the Kaaba. And they can never do anything wrong because they're holy people. This was their idea. So if you had said something against them or your message goes against them, they could not believe it. They were blinded by the Quraysh, meaning their awe and their majesty, that they are the custodian of the Kaaba. How can they make mistakes? They cannot make mistakes. One of the issues that happens, and it becomes an obstacle for Haq and for the truth, my friends, is the fact that people are blinded by images. Right? They have an image of a people, of an organization, of a country, or so much, to such an extent that they're blinded by them, that even the wrong from them they accept as right because they think they're holy. It is like that, you know. When you start to have blind faith in anything, then you see that that blind faith is going to make you blind to even the truth that is clear in front of you. Right? If you remember the people who came out to the Battle of Jamal, and the she-camel that Aisha used to be on, the ulama then, they had made the image of that she-camel so holy that everyone thought it was a holy camel. Right? This is a holy camel because Ummul Mu'minis is on top of this and that. And they used to wait for that camel to throw out excretion so that they can hold on to that excretion. I mean, really, this blind faith was so much that when Haq was made clear by Imam Ali, they did not want to listen to it because we have holiness on our side. This is what happens when you start regarding things as holy for no reason and without any basis. When you do that, then you see that even when the truth is laid out in front of you, it's difficult for you to accept it. You cannot accept it because you think that what I have is holy and has no basis. My friends, this is what happened with this tribe. They said, no, we cannot go against the tribe of Quraysh because they're holy people and they're holy. Now, even in this situation, the Prophet offered them that, listen, Allah is going to give you victory and you will marry Iranian women. And the men, the Iranian men will become slaves to you. Like, you know, they're looking at him. Okay, you know what? I mean, it's a tempting offer, but we can't, you know, accept it because the risk is too much. Now, obviously, they didn't mention the real reason because after that, you know, the idea was Abu Lahab used to go behind the Prophet everywhere, Abu Jahl and Abu Lahab. And everywhere the Prophet went, they would go behind him to tell the people, listen, don't believe in him, this guy is a madman. So when Abu Lahab, he came after the Prophet to this tribe and informed them, listen, don't listen to him, I know him, he's a madman. They said, you see, we knew it. He was saying that the Iranian women will be our wives. You know, they couldn't believe that. And they let it go. My friend, this is the attitude that he faced in face of the tabligh and the logical arguments that he's giving. One thing. Now he went to another tribe, for example. Right? And these, you know, obviously when you look at them are hilarious. Right? I mean, they're hilarious when you look at them, but really, it is sad to see human beings like that, and especially sad to see his ummah that he has left, us Muslims, behaving like that. That these people who are kuffar, okay, we can expect them to behave like it, but at least ourselves, we need to make sure that what we believe in has basis and is logical. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now he went to another tribe, and this tribe that he went to, right, was known as Shayban, and it had three leaders that it had. And so he went to one of them. They had this big old hall there, and everyone was there. And, you know, so all of these three individuals who are the leaders were on their own thrones. So he went to the one that is the biggest. He said, I'm the messenger of Allah. So he said, okay, what is your message? And he started reading the ayat of Surah An'am then. And he read those ayat, and the guy was impressed. He said, all right, you know what? I mean, what you say is good and right, but because it has to do with religion, our religious head is over there, that leader. Go and speak to him. He is the religious head. He is the mullah that they have, you know, the alim. So he said, okay, go over there and speak to him. So the Prophet, okay. You know, so he went there and spoke to the religious leader. And he spoke to him about that. He said that, hey, you know, this is the message. These are the ayat. They learned that. He looked at it and he said, you know, it's very impressive. I've never heard it. And it's true what you are saying. It's very true what you're saying. But accepting you means that we will have to fight many big tribes. We have to take the animosity of many big tribes. So this is a political issue. You need to go and meet that leader over there. And so he went there to the third person. And he started speaking to him. And that person, he looked at it and he said, listen, you know, I'll tell you one thing. What you're saying is true. I understand it. But what happened is that next to us, the words that he said is that we are between Yemen and Iran. Right? We are situated between Yemen and Iran. We have to face both of these powers. Right? We have to face both of these powers. Iran came to attack us recently. It was so hard for us to make a peace treaty with them. We do not want to do anything that is going to harm that peace treaty. And accepting your message is that. Now, obviously, his argument was good. Meaning it was a sensible argument. He didn't say, oh, you're a madman, or you're this, or you're that. And Rasulullah praised them also. He said, all right, I mean, even though you didn't accept it, but you are speaking logically. Okay, you have a reason not to. Fine. He walked out of there appreciating that they at least gave a logical reason for not accepting it. But one thing he thought in between this, my friends, understand this very well. One thing he thought in between this. You see, if Prophet had wanted, he could have said, listen, you could still accept Iran as your leader because they had accepted Iran as their leader. So you could still accept Islam, you could still accept Iran as your leader. All I'm asking you to do is pray and fast. You can just pray, you can fast, you can worship Allah and still accept Iran as your leader. Because Iran was the big power, then they had made a treaty with them and they have accepted Iran as their leader. Rasulullah could have said that. But you see, he didn't want that. Allah didn't want that. And by not wanting it, he made it clear that Islam that was understood then was not a set of worship. It meant that even the government of Islam you have to accept. Even the government of Islam you have to accept. You just can't say, I'll take the prayer and fasting. Rasulullah will be happy with me. No. No, Iran, you can accept Iran, make him your leader. No, he said, no, you cannot accept that. Islam will not accept that Islam. Islam doesn't want that type of iman where you accept only the worship of Allah and this. Rasulullah could have made that offer, but by not making it and by refusing it, he went out. But this is a sign, and he showed that no, Islam is a whole package that you have to accept. You have to accept the whole package of Islam. When you enter Islam, it is the prayer, fasting, not just that. It is the whole system and government of Islam you have to accept. If you don't accept that, then these prayers and fasting, he could have given it to everyone. They would have all done it. But no, he did not accept it, my friends. This is a lesson that he is giving us in Seerah. If you want to understand the Seerah of the Prophet, if you want to know what is Islam in its reality, then we need to learn it from the Prophet. He could have said, just pray, just worship. Hey, they don't need to know anything. You know, you just need to worship. No. If you are going to take them as your leader, then Islam cannot be yours. You have to accept me as the leader. You have to accept Allah's wali as your leader. The wilayat has to be established. Right? This is the role of Islam, my friends. This is the role of Islam, and you see that. There are many other examples, you know, of the messages that he got. But I will end it over here for right now today. How many places he went. And then what did these people do now? Really, you know, it's very interesting what they did after this. Right? And because of that, you see slowly he was led to make hijrat. Right? And so the idea of Islam is to establish that wilayat. That wilayat, if you accept anything else other than this, then it cannot be. That cannot be Islam. If you accept the authority of kufr or the authority of shirk, it cannot be Islam. Right? And hence, when you look at the hidden meaning of Islam, you will see when you say amr bil ma'ruf and nahi anil munkar, really, my friends, you know, who can do amr bil ma'ruf? Right? Who can give a command? You know, if I come to you and say, do this, he's like, what? Do it. Are you okay? Like, listen, you might be the Maulana, but you can't order us around. Who can do Amr? Who can do Nahi? Have you ever looked into the meaning of these words? Amr bil Maruf. Do Amr mean? Amr doesn't mean request. Please do this, brothers. It is good. It is mustahab, recommended. Amr means give a command. Do it. Nahi means give a negative command. Don't do it. Who can do that? You know, everyone just says, who are you? Friends, the only time that Amr and Nahi, the word itself, is indicating that the only time you can establish Amr and Nahi is when you have authority. If the police comes to you and says, get in the car, you have to get in the car, otherwise handcuffs. If the police comes to you and says, lower that voice, that's it, you have to do it. Why? Because they have authority. The idea of Amr bil Maruf and Nahi al Munkar was to have authority so you can establish order in the society. That was the idea of Amr bil Maruf and Nahi al Munkar. Otherwise, this Amr and Nahi is useless in our times. What are we doing? We can't give Amr to anyone. What right do I have on you? What right do you have on me? We can only request each other, help each other, advise each other. We cannot do Amr and Nahi. Amr and Nahi meant that you need to have wilayat. This is what the Prophet meant when he said, no, if you accept them as your leader, then you cannot have Islam. In order for you to have Islam, you must accept the authority that Islam has given you. My friends, this is the secret behind it, this underlying secret of what Islam meant in those days. What was the meaning of Islam in those days? And this is the meaning of Islam that we need to get back to and understand. This is where it comes to. This is why you see all the sacrifices that were made were what? If Yazid was acceptable, then you know what? Imam Hussein had no issue. You know, Imam Hussein was fine. He was respected. He was honored. In fact, Yazid said, hey, you know what? You can live honorably, this and that. In fact, if you write books, I'll publish them. I'll publish the books you write. Right? All you have to do is give bayat and accept me as your leader. Accept me as your leader. That's it. Friends, understand this. What was the reason Imam Hussein said no? He had everything. It wasn't that he was poor and he was being oppressed. No. He had everything. But the one thing that was there was the fact that this person cannot be the leader of Muslims. The name of Allah cannot be tainted. That was the reason Imam Hussein stood up. Imam Hussein stood up and he said, Amr bil Maruf and Nahil Munkar. Imam Hussein stood up for that. And he sacrificed for that. How many sacrifices he gave for that? Allah has made the mourning of Imam Hussein a life for the believers. It's a life for the believer. It gives us life. When we cry, it gives us life inside of us. It gives us life inside of us. And the things that he went through, it wasn't easy. And then from there, what Imam Sajjad went through after that. I'm saying Imam Sajjad, really, when I looked at, you know, the other Anbiya and what they went through or supposedly went through. In one of the discussions with the Christians, they were explaining about Jesus and what he went through. I said, how long did he go through that? I mean, you mentioned he was on a cross, he was just carried and he was whipped and all this. How long did that happen for? One day? One day? Now let me tell you who Imam Sajjad is. Let me tell you who Imam Sajjad is. How many days was he dragged? How many days was he whipped? How many days was he hurt? How many days was he injured? And all of that, having Zainab and Umm Kulsum next to him, having his sisters around him, looking at the sisters and looking at his aunts around him, what he went through, Imam Sajjad went through, really, we cannot find an example in history of how, what kind of hardships that he went through. What kind of hardship Imam Sajjad went through. You know, it was the neck brace that he had. Really, it wasn't one day he carried it around. He carried it from Karbala to Kufa, Kufa to Sham. Everywhere he went, he had this neck brace that was so heavy on his neck that it was bolted into his neck by nails that went into his flesh. And it was so much, that injury was so deep, and it was so harsh that you see that even when he came back from Sham to Medina, when he came back from Sham to Medina and Muhammad the Hanafiya came to meet Imam Sajjad and he held Imam, he saw Imam Sajjad and he asked Imam Sajjad to come near and he hugged Imam Sajjad on the neck. Imam Sajjad cried out in pain and moved away from him and said, Uncle, please let go of me. He said, what is the matter, my nephew? You don't like me anymore. He said, it's not because of that. The injuries of the thawq and the neck brace that have gone in my neck are so deep that after even 1 year they're still hurting me. Sayyalamul ladina dalamu ayyamun qalabin yanqalam. Ya Mahmud bihaqi Muhammad, ya Allah bihaqi Ali, ya Fatir al-Samawat bihaqi Fatima, ya Muhsin bihaqi Hasan, ya Qadimul Ahsan bihaqi Hussein. Allah, give us the tawfiq and the blessing to be on the right paths. Give us the wasdom to understand your guidance. Haste the reappearance of our Imam. Make us his helper when he comes. Wa akhir ad-da'wana alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Salam.